Is God ever angry? And does he act on that anger? In 1740, it was one of the most important decades in American history. If you are any bit of a student, you will know that by 1740, there had been people in America for about a century, many who originally came because of religious purposes. But over that century, the churches didn't close, but the religious fervor had cooled. In fact, church had largely devolved into a social experiment, a place you went to have friends and little more than that. But as the 1740s were beginning, a young man from England came to America, a man by the name of George Whitefield, and he preached up and down the East Coast. In fact, it's said that he preached multiple times a day, and by the time he retired, he had preached 18,000 sermons to an estimated 10 million listeners. He preached of God's love, of God's salvation, and as he preached, people began to respond, and there was revival breaking out across the nation. In fact, it wasn't uncommon to come into a church service and have upwards of 100 people accept Christ on a Sunday. But one town stood alone, a town just not too far from Boston, a town by the name of Enfield, Connecticut. And on July 8th, 1741, some of the exact details have been lost, but tradition says that the pastor was unable to speak, and so they brought in a visiting speaker from a town basically in Boston, Northampton, Massachusetts. He chose to share a sermon that he had shared in his church with nice results. The people had said, good sermon, pastor, but little more than that. But on this Sunday, he would be unable to finish. Jonathan Edwards stood in the pulpit, and in his typical monotone fashion, not wanting anyone to respond because of his emotion, he began to read his sermon entitled, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. As he began to paint this picture of God's wrath, he went back to Deuteronomy chapter 32, where Moses, in his final sermon, lays out this blessing and this curse that was available to the nation. If they would worship God and God alone, if they would obey his word, that God would pour out more blessings than they could begin to imagine. But if they did not, God's wrath is what they would experience. Two-thirds of the way through the service, people began to shriek and to yell, what must I do to be saved? And Jonathan Edwards ended the sermon, and he went down and he prayed with many of them as God poured his spirit out in ways seldom seen. That sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, is held up in most literature textbooks as a classic, one of the greatest pieces of literature ever written by an American. But 200 and some years later, the idea of God's wrath isn't something that sits very well with most of us. Does God become angry? Does he ever act on it? Well, I think you have to ask those questions when you come to the book before us this morning. We're making our way through the 66 books of the Bible, and this morning we come to a book that, in all honesty, is not an easy one. It's the book of Lamentations. It's a book written by a prophet weeping as everyone, including himself, was experiencing God's wrath. Before we get there, let me see if I can just set it a little bit in its context, because I think it becomes pretty important. We've been going through the Old Testament, and we in the English Bible like to divide it four ways. We talk, first of all, about those first five books being the Law, or the Pentateuch, the writings of Moses. We then jumped into this extended time where we followed Joshua all the way to the exile and the return from exile. We had these 12 books called history. Then we jumped into the poetry, and we now find ourselves in the section called the prophets. So we begin with the major prophets, mostly because they're big books, and this fall we're going to jump to the minor prophets, the 12 books that are oftentimes much smaller. But that's not the way the Hebrews divided their Bible. I don't know if you've been watching the Bible Project videos. I've been encouraging you to do that, but they put together one simply on how the Bible was put together, and I want to just show a clip from that.
Contents, you'll notice the first three quarters is a collection called the Old Testament. If you look at the list of books, you'll see it's made up of 39 smaller works that are grouped into four main sections. The first five are called the Pentateuch, followed by the historical books, then the poetic books, and finally the books of the prophets. Now that seems simple enough, but actually it's more complicated and way more interesting. This arrangement of the books in a single volume called the Old Testament is a later Christian tradition that developed after Jesus and the apostles. In ancient Jewish tradition, these works were all on separate scrolls and were conceived of as a unified three-part collection called Tanakh. It's a Hebrew acronym for Torah, which means instruction, Nevi'im, which means prophets, and Ketuvim, which means writings. The Tanakh has the same books as the Protestant Old Testament, but they're arranged differently. The Torah corresponds to the Pentateuch, but the prophets consist of four historical narrative books and then the 15 works named after specific prophets. After this comes the writings, a diverse collection of poetic and narrative texts. Now this three-part design is really, really old. It's referred to in ancient Jewish texts like the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Wisdom of Ben Sira, even Jesus of Nazareth mentioned it. And that's because this three-part shape is woven into the compositional design of the scrolls themselves. If you pay attention, you'll discover that every scroll has been coordinated by means of cross-references that link each work into the larger three-part collection.
It goes on, but I've seen that before. In fact, I've showed that before. But something hit me this week. The Old Testament, as envisioned by the Jews, were three separate scrolls placed together in one beautified, unified whole. Three, but one. I don't want to make too much of it, but it is interesting. While the Trinity is not clearly seen in the Old Testament, in the writing itself, God begins to lay the foundation so that we would understand the majesty of his person. But anyway, back to these threefold divisions. There's the Torah, the five books, and then you come to the prophets and eventually the writing. And for the most part, it's similar to the way we divide it. There are some differences. In the Hebrew Bible, the books of Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles are not divided like they are in our Bible. There's simply a single volume. The book of Chronicles is actually a recollection, a summary, a review of everything that's transpired before, and it actually ends the Hebrew Old Testament. But as you come to the writings, there are three books that aren't there in the English Bible. The first is Ruth. We put Ruth chronologically with the book of Judges when it transpires. But it's fascinating to me that the Hebrews put it after the book of Proverbs. And do you remember how Proverbs ends? It ends with this extended poem on what does a woman who fears God looks like. Oh, you want to see in real life what a woman who fears God looks like? The book of Ruth follows the book of Proverbs. Daniel is a difficult book for the Jews to handle. It has tremendous prophecies, and so we have no problem putting it in the prophetical section. But the book of Daniel begins with a six-chapter biographical section, and then he jumps to his prophecies, but his prophecies really aren't about Israel. They're about the Gentile nations. They're about Babylon, followed by Persia, followed by Greece, followed by Rome. There is a mention of this kingdom that will come made without hands, but the Jews didn't really know what to do with it. The last that's there that's not in the prophets is the book of Lamentations. Now, it's interesting, maybe you don't know much about the Septuagint. The Septuagint was written in the 3rd to 2nd century B.C. as the Jews would be taken into exile, many to Babylon, some with Jeremiah will go down to Egypt, and soon they will lose the ability to read and understand Hebrew. Alexander the Great will not only bring Greek culture to the world, but the Greek language. And thus, by the 3rd century B.C., many of the Jews couldn't read Hebrew. And so the Bible is translated into the language of the people, Greek, by 70 scholars, thus the Septuagint. The Septuagint is remarkably similar to our Hebrew Old Testament, but there's a few places where it's a little different. One of them is in the book of Lamentations. If you remember back in the book of Psalms, many of the Psalms begin with a title. Psalm of David when he's running from Saul, or Psalm of Asaph. And we, when we were going through there, made the comment that I don't know exactly how to deal with them. Are they intended to be inspired scripture, or are they simply scribal additions to give us some background to help us understand? And the reality is, I don't know the answer to that. But often in the Hebrew text, that title will be verse 1. In the Septuagint, they include a title to the book of Lamentations. Remember, Jeremiah ends up in Egypt. The Septuagint, being translated in Egypt, begins this way: "And it happened after Israel was taken captive and Jerusalem was laid waste, Jeremiah sat weeping and gave this lament over Jerusalem and said." And thus the Septuagint moved the book of Lamentation from the writings and put it immediately after the book of Jeremiah. If you're reading through the books, time for a commercial, I would strongly encourage, if you haven't been reading, we've got one more big book left, the book of Ezekiel, in 2 weeks. You get 2 weeks to read it, and then we're down to books that have no more than 12 chapters and probably won't take more than an hour of your time. I would strongly encourage you the rest of the year to read, even if you haven't. Done with commercial, back to the normally scheduled sermon. The book of Lamentations falls after Jeremiah, and I think it provides an incredible understanding as to what transpires. As Jeremiah ends, he ends in chapter 52 with these descriptive words. "So on January 15th, during the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon led his entire army against Jerusalem. They surrounded the city. They built siege ramps against the walls. Jerusalem was kept under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah's reign. And by July 18th, in the 11th year of Zedekiah's reign, the famine in the city had become very severe, and the last of the food was entirely gone." I don't think I'm incorrect in suggesting none of us in this room have ever really experienced starvation. We know what hunger is. If you watch the TV or listen to the newspaper or listen to the radio or read the newspaper, you've probably seen the PSA that one out of every five children go to bed hungry. I'm not trying to suggest hunger doesn't exist in America, because it does, but not hunger like this. In 2 Kings chapter 6, there's a similar siege. This took place in the northern tribes, the 10 northern kings, and they begin to describe what people were willing to do. And they share that people were spending money to buy a donkey's head. A donkey head has never been considered a delicacy. There's not lots of food on it, but people were buying it. But what's even more, the second thing they were buying was dove dung. How hungry would you have to be to pay to buy dove dung to eat? It continues with the story of a mother going to the king and attempting to sue the person she was living with because they had an agreement. "We'll eat my child today and yours tomorrow." I can't really wrap my head around cannibalism, but it's because I've never experienced what the Israel Jews were experiencing. No food for 18 months. And then it gets worse. In verse 7, "The section of the city wall was broken down and the soldiers fled. Since the city was surrounded by the Babylonians, they waited for nightfall." Speaking of the king and his guards, they slipped through the gate between the two walls behind the king's garden and headed towards the Jordan Valley. But the Babylonians' troop chased King Zedekiah, and they overtook him on the plains of Jericho. For his men had all deserted him and scattered. They captured the king. They took him to the king of Babylon in Riblah and in the land of Hamath. There the king of Babylon pronounced judgment on Zedekiah. And the king of Babylon made Zedekiah watch as he slaughtered his sons. He slaughtered all the officials of Judah at Riblah. Then he gouged out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him in bronze chains. And the king of Babylon led him away to Babylon. And Zedekiah remained there in prison until the day of his death. And then it gets worse. In verse 12, "On August 17th of that year, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard and the official of the Babylonian king, arrived in Jerusalem, and he burned the temple of the Lord." I can't begin to express how horrific that would have been. The temple is the place God's presence was physically manifested on planet Earth. It was the place you went to pray. It was the place that you went to be right with God. It was where you offered your sacrifices, and now it's gone. Seemingly never to be rebuilt. He will go on and he will share how that they will burn the city. They will burn the royal palaces. They'll even go as far as to knock down all of the walls. Everything Jeremiah and his people had once considered precious are gone. How do you move forward? How do you endure? Well, if the Septuagint is to be believed, Jeremiah sits on a hill as the city of Jerusalem burns, and he writes this not book. It's really a series of five separate poems. It's five separate funeral dirges. The first is from the perspective of a mourning wife, and then it's a weeping daughter, then an afflicted man. He takes the personification of gold tarnished, and he ends with this fatherless child. It really is an amazing creation. If you watch the video this week, you know that it is an acrostic. An acrostic meaning that the first verse of each line takes on the first letter of the Hebrew alphabets, the Aleph, Beth, Gimel, and so on. And the Hebrew alphabet has some 22. They call them radicals, not characters, but they have 22. And thus, in chapter 1, verse 1 begins with the letter A and B and the equivalent thereof. And it really kind of struck me. He does that for three of the five chapters. In chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 4, he does that. Chapter 5 is also the same length, but it's not an acrostic. Chapter 3 will actually be an acrostic, but three verses will begin with Aleph. And then three verses begin with the second letter, Beth, and three letters, and so on. It really hit me because I must admit, I normally think of poetry as this thing that you sit down and just flows. I don't know how it hits anybody. It never hits me. But maybe it hits you, and you just simply sit down and you write. How long would it take you to write a 22-line poem with each line beginning with the proper letter of the alphabet? This is not just something thrown together. This is thoughtfully worked over. But the second thing that hit me is the reason he does that most likely is so it's easy to memorize. We live in the most amazing time in human history. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to suggest every single house in this building this morning has multiple copies of God's Word. In fact, I think most of us have Bibles sitting on shelves that we haven't opened in weeks because they're spares. They're old copies that we can't throw away, but we're not sure what to do with. Now we're moving into an era where I rarely even open a Bible because I have an electronic copy. In fact, I have several different Bible apps on my phone. I never go anywhere without it. And because it is so easily accessible, I fall prey. I suspect some of you do, to not taking the time to memorize it. Imagine if the only part of God's Word that you had was that which you memorized. How much would you have? And I think part of what Jeremiah is doing is he's wanting so desperately for this horror to be remembered that he makes it as easy as possible to be committed to memory. But the question then quickly comes is, can I learn anything from it? Is the point, as is the case with poetry, something simply to be felt? When we were going through the Song of Solomon, I shared that it wasn't Solomon's intention to try and give us graphic ideas on how marriage should work. It was the opportunity to feel the passion that marriage should bring. And I would say the same thing about the Book of Lamentations. It's not intended to share with us the very details of what was transpiring. No, he wants us to feel the anguish of losing everything. But can I learn anything? Can you? Well, I think God brings at least Jeremiah, and I hope some of his fellow Israelites, to at least a couple truths. Chapter 1 really becomes this consummation of learning to confess sins. He begins in verse number 1 by saying, "How deserted lies the city, once so full of people. How like a widow is she who once was great among the nations, she who was queen among the provinces, has now become a slave." But this shouldn't have surprised them. We could go back to Deuteronomy 32, where Jonathan Edwards went, and we could see God's promise. God promises not only to bless, but God also promises to curse. But I want to go back to 2 Kings. In 2 Kings chapter 7, it's the story of Solomon dedicating the temple. And if you remember, he dedicates the temple and he prays an amazing prayer. And then as the chapter goes on, God returns. And he promises that as long as they worship him, as long as they obey him, he will bless them in ways beyond anything they could imagine. But in verse number 19, he says, "But if you turn away and forsake the decrees and the commands that I have given you and go off to serve other gods and worship them, then I will uproot Israel from my land, which I have given them, and I will reject this temple, and I have consecrated for my name. I will make it a byword and an object of ridicule among all people. And though this temple is now so imposing, all who pass by will be appalled and say, 'Why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this temple?' And people will answer, 'Because they have forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of Egypt, and have embraced other gods, worshiping and serving them. That is why he brought all this disaster on them.'" And as Jeremiah writes, everyone who walked by would have been appalled by what they saw. And they would ask, why would God allow this suffering to go on? And the answer had to be, because they chose not to worship God. Chapter 1 ends with a confession. Jeremiah writes, "The Lord is righteous, yet I rebelled against his command." Have you ever noticed how much easier it is to confess for somebody else? Oh man, you guys have problems. Me? I don't know if I can see that or not. Jeremiah, if anybody could have stood and said, "God, it's their fault." That's not what Jeremiah does. "I rebelled against his command. See, O Lord, how distressed I am. I am in torment within me, and in my heart I am disturbed, for I have been most rebellious. Outside the sword bereaves, inside there is only death. Let all their wickedness come before you. Deal with them as you have dealt with me because of all my sins. My groans are many. My heart is faint." Please do not hear me to say that all suffering is a result of your sin. We were in Job a few months ago, and Job suffers not because he's sinful, but because he's righteous. You can go to John chapter 10, and the disciples will say to Jesus, "Is this man blind because he sinned or because his parents sinned?" And Jesus will say, "Neither. It's so that you can see the glory of God's power." Not all suffering is a result of your sin. But when suffering comes, I would suggest it's an incredibly important time to step back. Say, "God, where am I? Have I sinned?" And take the time to prayerfully examine your heart, being willing to confess it. But Jeremiah moves on, and in chapters 2 and in chapters 4, he really focuses on the fact that it is God who sends the punishment. It would have been really easy to blame the Babylonians. The reason why we're suffering is because those are bad Babylonians. It wouldn't even be that hard to blame the army. If the army had just stepped up a little bit, we wouldn't be suffering. If the guys who built the wall had built it a little more solidly, if the farmers had planted and reaped a little more, it could have been blamed on anybody. But Jeremiah recognizes this is from the hand of God. How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with the cloud of his anger. He has hurled down the splendor of Israel from heaven to earth. In his fierce anger, he has cut off every horn of Israel. He has withdrawn his right hand at the approach of the enemy. The Lord has rejected his altar and abandoned his sanctuary. He's handed over them to the wall. The Lord determined to tear down the wall around the daughter of Zion. The Lord has done what he planned. He has fulfilled his word. He has decreed long ago. He has overtaken you without pity. He has let the enemy gloat over you. He has exalted the horn of your foes. God does bring suffering. It's not that all bad things come from Satan and all good things come from God. Sometimes God brings hardship to awaken us, to judge us, to get us to turn to him. Go back and read the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah pleads with the people, please turn now. But they wouldn't. And thus judgment came. But not only is it to recognize the judge, it is to petition their God. The book of Jeremiah is kind of an interesting writing. It begins with this acrostic, but then chapter 5 is different than the first four chapters. The first four are very orderly, linear, structured. But as he comes to chapter 5, it's disordered. It's confusing. It's filled with pain. In fact, chapter 5 is going to stand to the structure of the first four chapters. It's not an acrostic. In fact, it helps us understand that sometimes life is hard to understand. And when we struggle, where we should go is to our Savior. He ends chapter 5 with these words. He says, you, O Lord, reign forever. Your throne endures from generation to generation. Why do you always forget us? Why do you forsake us so long? Restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may return. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and are angry with us beyond measure. One of the fascinating parts, you see it in the Psalms often, you certainly see it in the book of Lamentations, is God is not upset when you are honest with him. You know, I fear that we as good Americans, we never really do suffer. I mean, I bet if somebody asked you today how you were doing, your answer went something like this: fine, good. We don't like to ever admit that we're suffering. And yet the reality is, some of you are. Some of you may be suffering minor discomfort. I suspect some are hurting deeply. And we think we have to pretend like everything's okay. Jeremiah doesn't pretend. In fact, the way the book ends is interesting. God, restore us! Or are you done with us? And it ends. Jeremiah hurt. He hurt deeply. He wept intensely. If you remember Jeremiah in chapter 5, he says, I wish my eyes were rivers so that I could cry day and night. But he knows where to go. If we were to end there, Lamentations would truly be one of the most depressing books in the Bible. But the book of Lamentations really is a chiastic structure, if you want a big word. It's the Greek word for the letter X. And the point is that the entire book points us to the very middle. Chapter 1 and chapter 5 are very similar. Chapter 2 and chapter 4 are very similar. But all of them point us to chapter 3. And in fact, the very center of the book, the very pinnacle of the book, in light of everything else that's said, may make the book of Lamentations one of the most amazing books ever written. Because as he sees all of this suffering around him, he says, I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall. I remember them and my soul is downcast. Yet this I call to mind. I have to choose to remember this. And when I do, I have hope. What does Jeremiah remember? Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. For his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. You miss it in English, but in Hebrew, the word love, the word compassion, and the word faithfulness are all plural. Jeremiah takes the time to recount to himself the many expressions of God's love, the many expressions of God's compassions, the continual expressions of God's faithfulness. And even when the world literally is burning around him, Jeremiah is encouraged, because every single morning, as the struggles and sorrow arise, God's faithfulness is good. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for him. The Lord is good to those whose hope is in him. To the one who seeks him, it is good to wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for a man to bear the yoke while he is young. Let him sit alone in silence, for the Lord has laid it on him. Let him bury his face in the dust. There may yet be hope. Let him offer his cheek to the one who would strike him, and let him be filled with disgrace. For men are cast off by the Lord forever. Though he brings grief, he will show compassion. So great, and this is my favorite Hebrew word, so great is his chesed, his unfailing love. Evelyn Brand grew up in one of the nicest circles in England. At age 22, she left the Conservatory of Art and felt God's call to India to be a missionary. And she arrived in the city of Madras and began to serve there as a single lady. She met and soon was introduced to a young man by the name of Jesse. He was the all-purpose guy. He could heal people's wounds. He knew how to build a house. He knew how to find water. He had made it his life mission to take the gospel to the Kalimali Hills of southern India. It was a deeply Hinduistic place. In fact, as he went there, and eventually as Evelyn, or Evie, as she would become called, went with him, they began to minister, and for years they healed the sick. They stitched up the wounds. They showed the villagers how to find fresh water, how to make certain that the outhouses were not connected to the drinking water, how they could increase the amount that they could grow. They shared the gospel of Jesus Christ, but every time somebody was interested in listening, one of the Hindu priests would get their ear and remind them of the horrors that they would experience if they followed these gods of the West. One day, one of the Hindu priests got sick. Jesse, as some thought, took love to his enemy. In fact, he spent days, weeks with him, nursing him back to life. And when the Hindu priest recovered, he turned from his Hinduism to Christ. And a revival began to spread. But then at the age of 44, Jesse got bitten by a mosquito, soon contracted malaria, and what's worse, what they called at that time the black water fever hit him. And Evie, at the age of 44, with two small children, lost her husband. She went back to England. She spent a year recuperating, trying to figure out her life. And finally, the time came where she decided she wanted to go back to India. The mission board said, a single lady can't go back to India. Her family said, no, Mom, you've served long enough. But she felt God's call. And so she went back, and she served for another 21 years. And at age 65, she fell and broke a hip. She left the hills and had to go down to the plains, where she was in the hospital, and she found herself on a carpet, and she would literally drag herself from room to room, sharing the gospel of Christ with anyone who would listen. Finally, she got good enough to walk again, and her son, Paul, who would become a missionary doctor, in fact, would be the one who would find the cure for leprosy, begged her, Mom, you've spent 40 years here. That's long enough. Let somebody else do it. And Evie said, when somebody replaces me, then I will go home. At the age of 65, she returned to the hills. She reached the first five hills, but she wasn't satisfied. She continued until at age 92, she fell again. She went down to the plains once again, and this time her language was jarbled and in just a few days, passed away. On one of the final visits Paul would ever have with his mom, he wrote in his diary, "It is amazing how beautiful one is when you lose everything but love." When they were cleaning up her things, they found this poem in her belongings. She wrote, "Why do you have to break me first? Why did you take my all away before you satisfied my thirst? Why must I sink in deepest deep before the promises to know? I realize now it had to be before he taught my soul to pray, before the glory I could see, the glory that he promised to me." I think if Evie Brand were here this morning, enduring a life of intense hardship, she would say with the prophet Jeremiah, "Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. For his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness." I'd like to close this morning by singing the hymn that was based on these words, "Great is thy faithfulness."